Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. This has been an eventful year when it comes to Iranian filmmakers. First, Iran's culture ministry formally dissolved the House of Cinema. This was the only domestic organization that supports independent film. The ministry replaced the House of Cinema with a committee that would not deviate from strict Islamic guidelines and politically permissible topics. Then, an independently produced Iranian film, A Separation, won the Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film. The film, directed by Asghar Farhadi, depicts the breakup of a marriage and is not considered a political film. Also this year, Jafar Panahi, an Iranian filmmaker who's under house arrest, was awarded the European Parliament's Sakharov Prize for Freedom of Thought. Joining us to explore the dynamics of Iranian filmmaking inside and outside of the country is Nagar Motahare. Nagar is an associate professor of literature and women's studies at Duke University. She's the author of Displaced Allegories, Post-Revolutionary Iranian Cinema. And she's written extensively on Iranian cinema and its representation of women under the rule of the Islamic Republic of Iran. More recently, she's been writing about social media in Iran. Welcome to Global Journalist.
Thank you so much.
I'm glad you're here as well. I wanted to ask you right off, how did you become so interested in Iranian film?
Well, in the 1990s, Iranian cinema really became quite popular, and this is the time when I was in graduate school and working with several professors at the University of Minnesota who were also working on film. I had no intention on working on film myself towards my PhD, but they were writing books on film and on the question of whether national cinemas had their own cinematic language. In a sense, not foreign language films, but foreign film languages was sort of the idea behind the books that they were writing. How is the grammar of a foreign film different, say, than a Hollywood film? And so my interest in these films that were circulating, these Iranian films that were circulating in the film festival circuit, my interest became more academic. And I started exploring the question, why is it that Iranian cinema looks and in some ways feels differently than other cinemas that I see in the theaters? And that's how I became interested in Iranian cinema.
And I guess people might presume that since you grew up in Iran and left as a child and have been back, and your mother was an artist in Iran, that that might have some impact. But do you think that it was subconsciously some interest there?
Well, I mean, I had the language skills to pursue Iranian cinema, you know, to pursue it more academically, certainly. But I also had to get trained not only in the language of cinema itself, the grammar of cinema, but also in, because I think that there is a, you know, we assume that we understand films because it's visual, but actually there is a grammar to the way that films are presented to the eyes and ears, and I had to learn that in addition to, you know, learning Arabic and to some extent more Persian in order to be able to pursue this research.
And what's I'm trying to get across to some of the obstacles that filmmakers in Iran have to overcome that Western filmmakers don't have to be concerned about. Could you talk about these obstacles a bit?
Well, there are I suppose there are some obstacles. Most of them are cultural, and they're grounded in the differences between Western culture and also the Shia culture that dominates Iran politically. So what happened after the 1979 Iranian Revolution was that the Islamic Republic of Iran established a certain number of laws and rules regulating the behavior of men and women, essentially towards each other, and the way that women could be seen by men. So there were a certain number of rules that were applied in society in general that were then translated into laws governing the look in cinema itself, or the gaze, as some would say, the gaze of the cinematic gaze. In cinema, this is referred to as the commandment of looking. So how do men and women look at each other? How do men look at women in cinema? When can there be contact? How is there contact? But also how a man in the theater can see a woman on screen. So all of these relationships, even though they're not screenic or in real life, have certain rules. And these rules need to be overcome. I think the primary thing that we gravitate towards in the West when we think about Muslim-majority countries is that women veil. And so I think that is one of the obstacles, too, that Iranian filmmakers have to deal with. How do you light a body that is veiled? How do you distinguish her from her dark background? How do you light, a piece of cloth, a piece of black cloth, such that you can see movement and feeling and communicate that on screen? So these are, in part, the obstacles that filmmakers have to deal with. Aside from having to abstain from certain regulations, such as abstain from certain things, such as representing violence or sexual relations.
What are some examples that you find interesting of the way these creative artists overcome these obstacles, such as not being able to show affection by kissing or touching?
Oh, my goodness. There are so many beautiful ways that the filmmakers have found a solution to these questions of how to represent intimacy. Well, in the early years of Iranian cinema, this was usually solved by separating the husband and wife in some way. So the husband would be working the night shift and the wife would be working during the day. And so the only way that they communicated with each other was through a tape recorder. And in this tape recorder, they would recite poetry and talk about their days. So intimacy was actually, the site of their intimacy was in fact the tape recorder and the exchanges that they did via the tape recorder. There are also scenes in Iranian cinema where newlyweds are going to part, and a cat becomes the site of that, Hollywood kiss. She strokes the cat, then he strokes the cat, and then we know that we've had, the final parting kiss.
That is creative. Now, can we talk a bit about the separation why it was so successful? I thought that it gave me quite a bit of insight into Iran, particularly how the religion is ingrained in their personalities, and it's not the big deal that the religion is sometimes portrayed to the West, to this couple and their family members. Why do you think that the separation became so popular?
Well, I think that it pays attention to all sorts of things. I mean, it's melodramatic. It is about a relationship. These are things that we like. There is, to some extent, some tension and violence. But I think that what is really beautifully done in this film is a portrayal of class differences as well as gender differences. And, of course, religion plays a big part in representing these differences as well, in profiling these differences very beautifully. It's one of the more realistic films that I've seen in recent years. Travel abroad as a film from Iran. Usually, a lot of the films that come from Iran to film festivals, portray rural rather than urban situations, wide angle shots of fields of grass and hay and so forth. So this was a surprising portrayal, I think, of Iran for many film festival goers.
Yeah, and I understand that there was some conflict between Farhadi and the government censors while the film was being made, but then it became the country's official entry into the Oscar category and some other award contest that it did well in. Can you talk about that dynamic? Did you consider that to be a milestone? The fact that it did became the official entry, and it was not a real necessarily a positive movie about Iranians.
I think that it's a total milestone, of course. But I think that there is always some level of struggle between filmmakers and especially the more independent filmmakers and the Ministry of Culture and Guidance. There are several levels of, I wouldn't say, well, yes, there are several layers of censorship and control that go into making and producing and distributing Iranian films. And so at the level of script, at the level of filming, at the level of where the film is allowed to be screened and when it's not, where it's not, film theaters are classified A, B, and C, and the films that the government would see as not conducive to portraying its most cherished image go to, lower class film theaters. So there are many levels at which one a film can be stopped or can be stayed. And it certainly is a milestone to be able to even get an Iranian film onto the film festival circuit, I think.
Okay, let's contrast that with one of Iran's other major filmmakers, Jafar Panahi. He came out fairly recently with I guess you would call it a bootleg film. This is not a film. Could you talk a bit about what he's gone through in Iran in trying to pursue his craft?
Jafar Panahi was arrested twice during the 2009 post-election crisis. There was an election in which Mahmoud Ahmadinejad once again won the presidency, and many believed that this was a fraudulent election. And I think that Jafar Panahi came out in public as one of the supporters of the opposition and a supporter of the reformist candidates who were up for the vote as well and who essentially lost the vote in this election. So he, along with thousands and thousands of Iranians went into the streets after the 2009 summer elections and protested and was arrested at one point at the Behesht-e Zahra Cemetery, where some of the men, actually young women and men, who died during the post-election protests were buried. He was then released and at a later date was again arrested along with other filmmakers who had come to his house to, think of a future film that they wanted to make. So the intention was to at some point make a film. It wasn't clear what it was, but it was the fact that they had intended on making a movie that was the basis for their arrest at that time. And he went on a hunger strike in prison, and the government eventually, after, I believe, 3 months, released him under a great deal of pressure from the international film community, as well as the community in Iran.
But he was able to do a film and get it smuggled out this year. And can you tell us a little bit about This Is Not a Film?
Essentially, when he was released from prison, he was put under house arrest. He was given... in fact, his sentence is that he will be under house arrest for the next 6 years, five, I guess, now, and that he is not allowed to make a film or give an interview for the next 20 years. And so the film was about him in his house, waiting around to hear about the verdict, and imagining a film that he would make were he to make a film.
Right.
And it is also about his relationship with the neighbors who come and go, and who he encounters when he uses the elevator to bring the trash out. Very simple film,
yeah,
but also very beautiful.
When you saw it, what did you think of it?
Well, I thought that it was very creative, and it was, in many ways, I think that, I mean, okay, so this is a film that is essentially made on an iPhone. It was then put onto a thumb drive and smuggled out of the country to two film festivals in the West. So there is a hugely creative side to this film, to just the story of the making of the film and its distribution. But the film itself, I would say, is very much about, thematically, about the things that Panohi cares about. His films oftentimes portray situations in which confinement is the theme of the film. So his film Offside is about a group of women who want to watch the Bahrain Iran qualifying match for the 2006 World Cup.
Okay.
Right. So, and it's about them trying in every possible way to get into the football, to see the football match, the soccer match. Many of his films are quite like that. It's really about, even though they focus on sometimes on women, they're really about restriction and confinement and the ways in which we manage to find freedoms, mm-hmm, irregardless of the limitations that are placed on us. And I think this film, This Is Not a Film, is precisely an answer to the confinement that the government has placed on him, that he can't leave his house for 6 years or make movies for 20. And so his answer is to make This Is Not a Film.
Okay. Well, I'd like to now talk to you a bit about what you consider the best films, best Iranian films. But before we continue our discussion, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You can also find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to our program on our website. On our site this week is a timeline of the oppression of feature and documentary filmmakers in Iran, including bans, arrests, assaults, and exile, and movies that received international acclaim, such as The Separation, and also one of Panahi's films, The Circle, for example. So please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org or our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at GJJournalist. So I wanted to ask you a bit about what you consider the best films that to come out of Iran.
I have a favorite film. Is that what you're asking me?
Let's start with that.
My favorite film is The Wind Will Carry Us by Abbas Kiarostami. He is now an acclaimed international auteur, but he was a filmmaker before the revolution, essentially making films, documentaries, and short films about children for the institution, the film institution for children and youth in Iran at the time.
Okay. Any others that we should know about?
Oh, I would say there are so many. So The Wind Will Carry Us, I would say Mohsen Mahmadbaf's Gappe, Tahmine Milani's Two Women. There are many, many films to watch, but I'm not always sure what to recommend that are accessible, but these three films definitely are.
Okay. And how has the lower expense of digital filmmaking affected the Iranian movie industry? Are you familiar at all with that aspect?
I would say that Abbas Kiarostami was one of the first to experiment with the digital camera in Iran, at least one of the first among the well-known filmmakers at the time. He made ABC Africa, which was about the children of AIDS victims in Africa. Really a very joyful film, a celebration of life in the face of death. And after that, he made other films that using the digital camera, including a series of shorts he called Five, and they're dedicated to the Japanese filmmaker Ozu. And I think after his ABC Africa, many other filmmakers and many of his students picked up the digital camera and started filming, and I think a lot of the growing Iranian film industry owes its debt to the use of this, to the digital camera.
Let's talk a bit about the favorite, some of the films that Iranians like to watch. I know that there may be a thriving black market. Are you familiar with how the black market for films works in Iran?
I am somewhat familiar, yes. I would say, for example, Jafar Panahi talks about his film Offsite and how it would have probably been a box office hit had it not been banned from the screens just days before it was due in the theaters. As a result of the ban, the film became incredibly popular in the black market, and probably it's one of the most watched films in Iran today, just by people copying DVDs or buying DVDs off the black market.
Any other examples of films that Iranians like to watch?
I think that, like many of us around the world, Iranians are interested in melodramas and action films and Bollywood films and thrillers, and love stories, and they're all available on the black market.
Okay. I wanted to just kind of wind down the program with, you know, getting back to the separation. When you heard about this award going to the separation, how were you? What did that make you feel like?
Oh, it was such a thrill to see him get the prize. Of course.
Okay, and and I guess also wanted to see what you think is going to happen with Panahi now that this bootlegged film has come out. Do you think he's somewhat inoculated because of his popularity, or do you think that that he's facing consequences?
I think that he will be. I think that he will be safe because his case is well known around the world. There are others who continue to be imprisoned and suffer that don't have his privileges. So I think he will find ways.
Okay. All right, well...
that he will be safe.
Okay, well, we've come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalist, produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Joining us today was Nagar Matahade. Global Journalist is directed by Travis McMillan. Raymond Tungekar is our executive producer. An Chi Du was our lead producer, assisted by Kevin Dubois. Now stay with us for Free Press Watch and join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.
665 journalists have been murdered worldwide since 1992, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. Nearly 90% of those cases remain unpunished. As part of Global Journalists Impunity Project, a group of University of Missouri students gathered to remember some of those fallen journalists. Here are their stories.
My name is Giselle McCulligan. I'm 22, and I'm a Filipino-American student at the Missouri School of Journalism. November 3, 2012, Tehran, Iran. Sattar Beheshti, an Iranian critical blogger, was reported dead less than a week after Iranian police took him into custody on allegations of acting against national security. Press freedom groups pressured the government to clarify the circumstances of Beheshti's death.
My name is Taylor DeHaze. I'm 20 and an undergraduate student at the Missouri School of Journalism. January 2001, Xi'an, China. Feng Xiaojiao was found dead in a ditch with his throat slit. He was an investigative reporter for Gujia Daobao and wrote about criminal gangs and their links to corrupt politics. Days before his death, he received threatening calls and said he feared for his life. The day before he died, he moved into a new apartment for safety precautions.
My name is Nassim Benchaban. I'm 21, and I'm an Algerian-American student at the Missouri School of Journalism. 12, El Triunfo, Ecuador. Byron Baldion, a freelance photographer, was shot dead by two gunmen on a motorcycle in front of his home in Ecuador. Baldion was a witness in a criminal case involving alleged police corruption. After his testimony, five men, including three active-duty police officers, were arrested for theft. A special group of national police officers was supposed to investigate the murder.
My name is Elise Morowski. I'm 18 and an undergraduate student at the Missouri School of Journalism. January 11, 2012, Homs, Syria. Gilles Jacquier was among eight people killed by an explosion covering a pro-regime rally. Syrian authorities report that he was killed in a grenade attack by opposition. The French government is skeptical of this claim. It is speculated that the incident was an elaborate trap by the Syrian government.